Friendship. It is difficult to get a permit to raft through the Grand Canyon. For decades, there was a wait list. You would put in your name, and the National Park Service would say, "Current wait time is 20 years. In 2006, they switched to a lottery system that they still use today. This means you could win every year, or you could enter every year forever and never get picked at all. Chances of getting picked for a summer slot are less than 1%. It adds a bit of magic to being selected, as if the river chose you. There are ways, however, to boost your luck. If you get picked, you become a trip leader and get to invite 15 people on your trip. So, if you get 15 friends to apply, your chances go way up. If you've never been or you haven't been on a trip in 10 years, your name gets put in the pot 5 times. The more newbies you can get to apply, the better. I didn't know any of this when I was invited to go. I knew only that it was a once-in-a-lifetime kind of thing, the most epic 3-week trip in the United States, camping on secluded beaches surrounded by giant red cliffs 1 billion years old, stumbling upon Native American ruins and paintings, bathing in the ancient Colorado River and dancing under the stars. I heard that most people would never be chosen, so if someone invites you to go on their trip, you should go. Even if you hate them, just go. Luckily, these were dear friends of mine, my most adventurous friends. My friend Toby, the doctor who coached me through my illness that summer, is the one who got the permit. Leslie, his wife, is an environmental consultant, lobbying for salmon habitats and eco-literacy. They have ridden horses across Mongolia and biked across Korea, Japan, and Patagonia. They're those people, doers and big adventurers. And their crew of friends teams with memory makers and say-yesers. Among them, Whitney, my old roommate and the source of all of them in my life, who somehow holds a big boss job while always seeming to be camping on a distant cliff. They're the type of friends who will take 3 weeks off from work in March to raft the Colorado. All of them. And if their employers get pissy about it, they'll quit. I'd hung out with them in San Francisco and liked them a lot, but I was surprised when they asked me to join their trip. I was in the friend group, but not core. I was very flattered. Maybe they did it because they knew of my big bike trip, or because I'm as positive and averse to confrontation as a golden retriever puppy. When you're trapped with 16 people at the bottom of a canyon, group dynamics become paramount. Toby and a few of his friends had been lucky enough to do the trip before, and they said bad vibes had tainted the memory. Egos and annoyance and drunken makeout sessions that led to caught feelings and thick air. There was no escape, nothing to do but tolerate or shut down. The trip downriver takes 21 days, completely off the grid. They give you a satellite phone to check the weather or call a helicopter if someone snaps a femur. You pack 21 days worth of food, 21 days of booze, 21 days of toilet paper. And on that note, you shit in boxes and carry it with you. The trip is absolutely leave no trace. The dump you took on the first morning will stay with you until the last. If the weather's right, you sleep on a mat under the stars. If it's not right, you sleep in the tent you packed. We left on a Friday morning. An outfitter company called Seba put the trip together for us. The boats we rented, the dry suits that you wear while going through rapids, the shit boxes, the toilet setup called the Groover, and basically all the food. They plan out your meals down to the appetizer and entree. The launch point is a section of the Colorado River just south of Glen Canyon Dam, in a modest canyon in Navajo country that would hardly inspire a postcard. I had trouble believing that just downriver from here was the most epic water-carved land on planet Earth. We pulled up and saw our 5 inflated rubber boats on the riverbank, huge rafts like the rescue boats you'd see hanging off the back of a ferry. A white cargo truck opened its back door to reveal 3 weeks' worth of food and booze, all impeccably organized in gigantic coolers. Packing all this food and alcohol in tents and sleeping bags and clothes onto 5 boats seemed like some sort of pipe dream. When asked to pre-order booze for yourself for 3 weeks, every single person orders enough for a full 10-year apocalypse. The stuff looked like it needed a trans-Pacific barge. Yet through a feat of extraordinary jigsawing, the boats were packed. There was a clear hierarchy to our group, with Toby at the top. He had the satellite phone. He got to be the last word on how many miles we'd go each day and when we'd take rest days, usually once a week. He was the only one who looked at the weather and the map. Then came the 4 other boat captains, one for each of the other boats. All of them had some level of whitewater rafting experience. Some grew up doing it. Some had gone down a river just once. It was their job to know what was on their boat and where, and to strap it all down each morning as we took off. Second to last came the passengers who had rafted before. Their expertise allowed them to mother the final lot, me and a few other newbies. We were there to be bossed around, to lean into our ignorance, and give those with more experience the chance to feel not only needed, but wise. Toby divided the 16 of us into 4 teams. 1 out of every 4 days, he explained, your team would make everyone's breakfast and dinner, set up the lunchtime sandwich station, set up the groover at the night's campsite, and then tear it all down and pack it onto the boats in the morning. Then, the other 3 days, you let the other teams serve you. We launched at midday from the shore and paddled through the humble beginnings of the canyon. Setting off put a spirit in my chest, a confirming, affirming swell. I was on an adventure, but not alone. I was part of a capable team, a nomadic family, a community. It got me thinking about what community actually is. Everyone wants it. Countless organizations say they offer it. Many people still go to church almost exclusively because of it. But where does community come from? I don't think it springs from simple proximity. Most Americans don't know their neighbors. There has to be an organizing principle, a gravity point, a reason why people are drawn together. It can be intentional, like with church, or circumstantial, like at a job. But communities always form for a reason, and that reason bears greatly on the type of community that's created. Not long ago, I went to hear Cheryl Strayed and Elizabeth Gilbert speak at UCLA. The auditorium was buzzing with energy, with writers and creatives. My friend remarked, "Everyone in here seems so nice and sweet. Look at their glowing faces." "Anyone who wants to hear these women speak is probably good-hearted," I said. At one point in the evening, Elizabeth Gilbert brought it up. "I hope you'll take a moment and meet the people sitting next to you. If you're here, you're probably pretty like-minded and probably awesome. Make a new friend today." When the evening was over, people stood in the aisles and talked and laughed and hugged. I think a lot of people lack positive community because they don't pay attention to the gravity points in their life. They don't seek out places that would attract the people they want to be surrounded by. Do you only know people from partying? From chance encounters or coworker proximity? Not all communities are equal. A violent mob is one kind of community. So is a mean-spirited lunch table of bullies. Those communities will satiate one part of the human need for tribe, but they will kill another, the need to be proud of who you are. Positive community is always formed around a group mission, whether it's beautifying a neighborhood or winning a political campaign or spreading the gospel. There is always something forming the community outside of the desire for community. It is a byproduct of purpose, not a purpose in and of itself. We need to find places of attraction that attract the human beings we want to be. Maybe it's church. Maybe it's volunteer work. Maybe it's a hiking club or an architecture tour. Either way, when we find these places, we must talk to the people there. As our group floated into the canyon, I felt the clearest sense of community I have ever known. All the complexities were stripped down to a tribal scenario. 16 people against a river. 16 people vetted for positivity and aptitude. 16 people who knew the spiritual salve of feeling small amid the bigness of nature. Our purposes? Make it downriver, enjoy the beauty, hike, get drunk, leave no trace. Learn about the people who lived here 10,000 years ago. Avoid drowning in the big rapids. Wear costumes. Sleep under the sky. As we moved into the canyon, the walls shot up. What had been a few hundred feet of cliff became 1,000. We had a book that explained the different layers of rock. As the Colorado dug out the American landscape on its way to the ocean, it unearthed bands of sediment that hadn't seen the sun in a billion years. The rim of the canyon is Kaibab limestone, which is roughly 270 million years old. Below it, 11 more layers of rock, with names like Surprise Canyon Formation and Mauve. They date back to as many as 550 million years ago, each one a different color and a relic of an epoch that makes human history feel like a fart in the wind. After that, there's a division in the rock called the Great Unconformity. Below that point, the rock leaps in age to over 700 million years. In some places, it's 1.8 billion years old. This is obviously when aliens harvested all of Earth's crust for some ghastly project. The oldest layer, called Vishnu Basement Rocks, is as far as the Colorado has carved. Who knows what it will reveal in millions more years? Being in the presence of age like that, it does something to you. You feel perspective. The air flexes with nature's royalty. And when you're experiencing it with 15 friends, all submerged in that profundity, it cements the bond. As we made our way through rapids and lunch spots and hikes to ancestral ruins, we moved like an organism. We would pull the boats up to a campsite in mid-afternoon after about 5 or 6 hours of river. The four people on dinner duty would pick their tent sites first, while the rest of us waited by the boats like a pride of lions honoring the established eating order. Once the kitchen crew had chosen the best spots, we would help unload the tables and the pots and pans. Then someone from the kitchen crew would go shopping. They'd take the binder with each night's dinner plan and sort through the boat's coolers for whatever meat and vegetables and snacks and appetizers were needed. Each of us had been asked to bring a specialty cocktail to make while the kitchen crew worked on dinner. Some people made old fashions. Others made gin and tonics. We had palomas with mezcal and somehow fresh grapefruit slices. During the cocktail hour, someone would build a fire pit while another found firewood. Someone would go off to a secluded spot, preferably with a view, to set up the groover. Everyone chatted while working, cocktails in hand, as the sun and temperature dropped. By the fifth night, we were a machine, choreographed ants going through the effortless motions of building our portable city. The clarity of everyone's job, the sense of being needed and seeing the immediate product of our labor, was satisfying. When we slept after the day's journey, the work of setting up, the hours of storytelling and booze, we slept hard. The desert night air was cold in our nostrils. When you woke up to pee, the stars were so close, it was like bumping your head on a chandelier. People often talk about the way we evolved. Whether it's popular diets, exercise regimens, or theories for why humans act in the way we do, the allure of getting back to our evolutionary roots is a common selling point. We shouldn't be eating refined carbohydrates that our bodies didn't evolve to digest. We shouldn't be sedentary. Monogamy isn't natural. Should we actually be barefoot all the time? It all circles around the idea of primal humankind, the way we were for millions of years before history was written down, before nature was tamed and paved and air-conditioned. I don't know what's true and what's marketing, but I can tell you this. Being in a small group of people with clear purpose and direction, with delineated roles that brought direct benefit to the group, with the flexibility to change or adapt, and with enough intimacy that social pressure could correct sour behavior. It felt like I was being human on the deepest level, an elemental, smooth-functioning humanity that I don't usually experience in our complex, anonymous society. Each day, we would run into some rapids. A few days, we had big ones. We put on helmets and made sure every water bottle and lunchbox was strapped down. Each boat captain handled the rapids differently. Some made jokes, but kept their eyes on the water like hunting owls. Some became dead serious, calling out danger spots to the boats behind them. Our greatest concern were holes, spots where the water rushes over a large, submerged boulder to create a sudden swirling depression, a deadly churning. It is there that a boat can be sucked down and flipped, launching the people into the air or shoving them to the river floor. More than 700 people have died on the river since they started counting in the mid-1800s. As we approached a rapid, I would make loud jokes. I loved the adrenaline. My friend Whitney was frightened. She would get quiet and hunch down and say very little. I hoped my frivolous joy lightened her mood. When our boat made it through each one, the camaraderie was buzzing. We'd survived something together. We'd worked as a group, protected one another. We popped beers and drank rosé from a bag. Most everyone on the trip did the full 3 weeks. I was only able to do 8 days. Not because I'm a city slicker or weak or afraid of rapids, but because I had a riding job that I couldn't miss. There is a point, 8 days deep into the canyon, a billion years into the rock, where a hiking trail reaches the Colorado from the rim above. It is called Phantom Ranch. From there, it is a 10-mile hike gaining 4,000 feet of elevation, from hot sun hitting the river to cold snow at the rim. When we planned the trip, two other people needed to leave early, so we coordinated with three friends to hike down from the rim on the night before we left. They were replacing us, making sure the machine kept functioning properly. There could be no missing pieces. As we ascended those massive cliffs, watching geology change from the core of the earth to the crowded vegetation and bustle of the higher layers, I felt myself return to the busyness of modern humans. My phone buzzed for the first time in 8 days. News had happened. I'd forgotten about the president and the trade war with China. People had invited me to birthdays and dinners. People had sent me memes. I felt immediately overwhelmed by the amount of information I had grown so accustomed to digesting. Some warm animal in me, which had finally come out to play on the river, retreated to his deep hole in the ground. Only in the last several hundred years has the average person been able to write a letter and send it to someone far away. Then, in the last 200 years, came the ability to talk instantly across large expanses. I remember using AOL Instant Messenger in college to tell a friend I was gay. This was before texting became commonplace. I remember feeling the historical weirdness of it in the moment. In the past, I would have written her a letter, and she would have had the night to sleep on what she read, to ponder her words and choose them. And then I would have had days of wondering and growing and processing myself. But here we were in 2002, typing instantly back and forth to each other. She was responding in real time, but I didn't have the richness of seeing her face, of being in her presence, of tempering my words with tone and fear and a shaky voice. She was reading cold black letters from 1,000 miles away. I remember her spinning, getting upset, and I couldn't console her. I tried calling, but she didn't answer. I thought, never in history has instant, distant writing been possible. This is a new thing. The itch to have friends, to engage with and be valued and seen by another person, gets scratched through the internet. Internet friendship is something, in the same way that masturbation is something. It feels good and serves a purpose, but it is not sex. Pornography is not sex either, and might even deform real sex. By giving us the visual piece of it for cheap, and keeping the hard and relational and tangible parts withheld, it can make us expect one form of ecstasy without important contextualization. Social media may be similar in this way. Don't get me wrong, I love social media, and I love the internet. I have friends on Instagram and Twitter, real friends, whom I've never met and never will. These things have value, and maybe they will bring us an altogether new type of relationship. But for now, we are physical creatures with a billion years of social wiring that includes physical presence, time spent together, touch, loyalty, inconveniencing the self by being by the other's side, helping them move homes or go to the doctor. The undigitizable experience of togetherness, of scents in the air and tasting the same food. The shallow scratching of text messages and notifications try to replicate the real. But I have seen how the constant buzzing of the phone, the lighting up, keeps me in the shallow plane, holds me up top. When I'm in conversation with a friend and my phone is near, I might see a text. Now the conversation is bifurcated into two paths. I am no longer fully there with my friend before me. I am also, at least in some part, with the friend who is pinging me from afar. Something of life is lost, some wholeness of experience, something we crave. 8 days in the Grand Canyon was such a short reprieve from the connected world, but it reached into me through my mouth and took hold of my spine and rattled me. I hadn't felt so simply alive in years. Most important, I really noticed. There are several types of friendships, but two main categories, circumstantial and kindred. The first kind happens among coworkers or classmates. They're around you for a reason, and you have fun times and good laughs. But you aren't cut from the same cloth. A kindred friend is different, someone who is on the same journey as you through life. Whether it's creative ambition, a spiritual bent, or a way of seeing the world, you find that you speak the same language and are fixated on the same books. You are headed to the same distant hill, one that no one else can see. In 10th grade, I had a realization that changed my life. A new girl named Joy came to our school and sat in front of me in Mr. Wagner's chemistry class. She was cool, funny, and smart. She thought I was too, even though she spoke like a worldly adult and I seemed to speak like a child. She didn't seem to notice that I was weird and awkward. She was kind to me. We would sit in her car, and she would play me Radiohead songs. We talked about family and life and God. I remember my young brain was so confused. To that point, I had only had friends who picked on me. They were smart and funny guys, but we were kids. Nothing was serious. Sarcasm was king, and my chubby cheeks and earnest enthusiasm were an easy target. But this new girl, she treated me completely differently. She made me see that there were friends out there who would be kind and make me a better person. I realized I wasn't stuck, that life is about who you're around. Your sense of self is built or broken by the company you keep. Thank you, Joy, for teaching me that. Around that time, I read Thomas Merton and became fixated on his idea that you are made in the image of what you desire. So I sought out people with integrity, cleverness, a sense of awe at the world, a lack of cynicism. If you desire friends only to appease your hunger for popularity, you'll feed that monster. But if you seek good people, wise people, not just to be associated with them, but to be good and wise yourself, I believe you will find them. As I've gotten older, maintaining friendships has become a choice and a challenge. When I was in high school and college, friendships were propped up by convenience, although I didn't know it then. We saw one another every day because we were in the halls together or on campus. It wasn't a choice. We were shoved into a school with hundreds of people, and we found the ones we liked. We shared gripes about teachers, about relationships, about family. When school is over, You might be lucky enough to work somewhere with coworkers that you like. Maybe you see them every day and have inside jokes, and it's all good. But lots of people don't have that. And the friendships you built in school take a lot of energy to maintain. Maybe your friends have moved away, or you have, or things have changed. Each year, I go camping with some guys I've been friends with for more than a decade. They've got wives, and a few of them have kids. We're at different stages of family, faith, philosophy, and career. Our paths crossed for a season, and then we went. But with a rare few humans in life, the urge to maintain overpowers the canyon of inconvenience, and you find yourself making plans. On our last trip, camping at the foot of the Eastern Sierras, we talked about surrendering to life's seasons, about sex, society, and poetry. We cooked our meals and stumbled back to our tents in the dark after too much whiskey. I took two puffs of a joint and laughed so hard trying to tell a joke that I cried and fell into a bush. There are elements I look for in friendship. Curiosity, the attraction to knowing what is true in spite of attachment to something already believed. Kindness and mischief, a foundational generosity toward others, but not in the way of the pious martyr who cannot laugh at the weirdness of people. I need you to love all, but smack their back and say, "Damn, you act a fool sometimes," laughing at the world and yourself in equal measure. Belief in something, in mystery or humanity or God or the beautiful bigness of space. Nihilists and critics make me tired. Awe. If you see the Milky Way on a clear night in the desert and don't gasp, if I point out a flower growing impossibly in the crack of cement and you don't look, I will annoy you. Absurdity. If you don't think God, sex, death, poop, or pain can ever be funny or absurd, I will offend you and you will wear me out in your uptightness. I'm in this life for the long haul and need the stamina of satire and absurdity to make it through. I need to laugh with my sinister friends to survive. Self. I need you to believe that you are worth the effort of exposition, of excavation, of education, that you matter and have something to give this world. It's okay if you don't know right now or often forget, but I need you to believe it in there somewhere. I want to grow with you, to be sharpened by you as I sharpen you. My friend Carly has to leave parties sometimes. It's hard for me to understand. She'll be doing fine and then, all of a sudden, flip. I need to go home. She says she absorbs the energy of everyone around her. She feels it all. She works in fashion, and her job sometimes requires that she attend influencer events. All that thirsty ambition and peacocking is like putting a fork in the wall socket. When Carly was young, her mother had been a grab bag of emotions. Each morning as a little girl, Carly would wake up and come downstairs and not know which mother she would be getting. Angry, happy, depressed, manic. So she learned to tread with care. She would come downstairs ready to become whoever she had to be to keep the peace, in order to survive. Now, as an adult, she can't help but walk into a room and feel it all. I am not sensitive to the room. I am a steady, smiling dog who wags his tail wherever he goes. But that often diminishes my empathy, my work as a friend. Someone will say, "What's wrong with Ryan?" And I'll be like, "What? Nothing. He seemed fine to me." And then I find out he's crying in the bathroom. Many of my closest friends have the opposite, a radius of the heart that reaches out and feels the beating of others. My friend Ruthie is like that, a human energy sponge. She feels the room in a way I do not. She and I were talking about this one day, and I got insecure about my dark, robotic heart. "Maybe this makes me a bad person," I said. "I don't notice other people's feelings." She stopped me. "It can be a good thing, Jed. Sometimes when people feel shitty, they don't want to dwell on it. They don't want to be treated like fragile glass. They want to feel normal, to be pulled out of their darkness. You treat everyone the same. Your energy is constant. Like every day is a new chance to be amazed. That can help people. Ruthie knows about human feelings. She's had to study her own for 20 years. At 17, she was T-boned in a car accident and broke her neck, permanently damaging her brainstem. For the last few decades, she has lived with chronic pain that I cannot comprehend. The broken nerves tell her brain that she is being ripped in half, all day, every day. She describes it as half of her body being on fire. Other forms of pain don't register. She has found herself standing on a fire ant hill, her leg brown with ants, all biting her. She had no idea. For most of her 20s, Ruthie was bedridden, taking the highest legal dose of fentanyl every day. Then her world fell apart. Her beloved father collapsed and died. She was married at the time, and her husband couldn't take it. He left her. She decided she couldn't keep going as she was, a burning human pile of drugs and loss. She decided to wean herself off all the medicine. Better to live in pain than live as a zombie. She started drinking alcohol at age 33. She had never been sexual with anyone other than her husband. She was, in many ways, so similar to me, feeling like her 20s had been some kind of testing ground or desert, rich in pain, but also in teaching. I seek Ruthie's counsel for all kinds of things, but especially interpersonal things. She's a student of her own mind, and her pain has given her a superhuman capacity to meet people where they hurt, to sit beside them in silence. In my comparatively monotone emotional experience, she colors the gray. As I beat myself up that day, she gave me perspective on the different roles we play. I do what I do, and it can help. You do what you do, and it can help. Some days we need a comforter. Some days we need perspective. Some days we need to stop staring in the mirror asking why and go outside and be amazed at the world. Some days we need a kick in the ass. This framing clicked for me. In Christianity, there's an idea called the body of Christ. Some of us are hands, while others are feet. Some ears and some mouths. If a foot sat around wishing it were the mouth, the body would never move. Every part has a function. Until it finds its place in the wholeness, the body is incomplete. I am not porous. I don't feel the room, and that's because I'm usually not in it. I'm 30,000 feet up. I see everything from above, and usually see it popping into the puzzle, completing some new part. This is why I write, to process what I see up there. Meanwhile, there are people in the room, holding hands, listening to each other with tears in their eyes. They are feeling everything, and they are saving hearts. We are part of the big body of the world. You have a role, so do I. That weirdness in you is the very thing someone needs. Ever notice how you can watch a press conference, and at the smallest squint of an eye, the subtlest tone of voice or word choice, your gut says, he's lying? Or do you ever go on a first date, and in the free flow of good conversation, you notice that his knee touched yours under the table, perhaps for 0.02 seconds instead of 0.01? The latter could have been an accident, but the former felt like exploratory affection. It registers immediately. Meanwhile, above the table, you're still talking about Broad City. Our brains are primed for social interaction. More than anything else, it's the skill that makes us human. Our schools and our tests look for aptitude and skills that can be measured and tallied, whether we're good at calculus or chemistry, for example. But this leaves out many a brilliant mind. I remember people from my high school who struggled to make B's and C's, but were social savants. Social interactions, human nuance, they knew every detail. But numbers and statistics and facts wouldn't stick in their minds. The tests and the pressure around memorization were brutal for them, so they failed and flunked or begged and scraped by. But when class let out, They ran the school with relationship advice and gossip and perfectly timed wit. They could maneuver a conversation or convince a teacher to give them a B, like Rachmaninoff playing the piano. I guess what I'm saying is, some of the most obvious geniuses I've ever met would never have scored high on the SAT, and I hate that they don't know how smart they are. I've seen someone craft a text message conversation between their friend and the friend's crush that should be studied by science, the nuance, the empathy, the imagined perspective and channeled flirtatious energy, the impossibly perfect word choices, the fullness of the evolved human brain computing 10,000 emotions and expectations in a millisecond and launching the text like a sniper's bullet. It's genius at work. When I was a kid in church, the Sunday school teachers would say, "Jesus died for you. Don't you feel loved? Don't you just feel so grateful to Jesus?" I would think to myself, "I mean, I guess, but he loves everyone, which means I'm not special. And if he didn't die for us, he'd be alone in heaven, so it all kind of makes sense." But as I've gotten older, the tables have been turned. I've always been told, "You love everyone, you make everyone feel uniquely seen." I spread myself around. I enjoy most people and can stay up all night talking to someone I just met. I've had dear friends say to me, "How do I know if I'm special to you? Everyone thinks they're special to you." There is a love that is abundance, that is never diminished, a love of humanity and the celebration of every beautiful thing. And there is a love that is scarcity, of choosing you over everyone else, of feeling special. Both kinds of love matter. I don't know which one is better, or if this ties into the idea that we are all parts of the body of the universe. Some of us love everyone. Some of us choose only a few. To be clear, I don't love everyone. I am just interested in everyone. I'll have a conversation and learn. I'll pay attention to them. And attention is often withheld from people. They feel invisible. So me noticing them, talking to them, asking follow-up questions, it can feel like love, even if it's more a byproduct of my curiosity. I suppose I am kind, but I'm not sure. How many personality traits masquerade as virtue? I've known people for years who still make me think, "Who are you really? I'm not sure." On the other hand, I've met people at parties who felt like old friends after one cocktail and a story about their trip to Trader Joe's. What is that? Where does that sense of connection come from? Some part of it is a chemical attraction, a mess of algorithms behind our consciousness that make these connections without our permission. We don't choose them, they just happen. Our animal soul recognizes another soul of its same kind and lights up. I couldn't tell you how a magnet works, but I know how it feels when one pulls. Language has something to do with it. I've had strangers come up to me in coffee shops who know me only from reading my stories on their cell phones. When they walk up and introduce themselves, we always hug. It's all very spooky and fun. I am part of them because something I wrote happened to speak to whoever it is they are. And I always like them too. We're the same in the important ways. All we want is for someone to know we exist and say, "I'm glad you're here." Try this today. Tell a friend you're happy they're here, that you're happy to know them. Tell them it's amazing to live with them floating on this rock in space. Maybe you'll catch them as they stop to get groceries. Remind them a supernova is eating a solar system somewhere at this very moment as they put bananas in their basket. It's happening right now. Recently, I was emailing with my friend Tom. He's been a source of wisdom and love to me for years, and he loves thinking out loud about what life means. I love how he thinks and how he makes me think. "When I am with you," he wrote, "the conversation moves so fast that I often must simply mark a certain thought and allow the conversation to continue without speaking to it. And one such thought was when you said, 'And it made me cry, not because it is sad, but because it is so true. Truth makes me cry.' In my old age, I have been experiencing that very, very frequently. I do not understand it well, I only feel it, and those around me must think it very, very odd. I cry daily, never because I am sad, often because I care deeply, but usually just because something so profoundly true or authentic has pierced me, and experiencing the weight of that truth or authenticity overwhelms me. I knew exactly how Tom felt. Tears are the swelling of something inside me, until that something gets too big for my body to hold. It makes room by pushing the tears out. In a movie, when a kid who has been bullied stands up for himself, or his friends show up for him, it makes me cry. Triumph makes me cry, too. Maybe you're in a season of crying because you're moving to Rwanda from Chicago, far away from everyone you know. Maybe some big loss or change is taking up the space in your head, and it's pushing tears out. Maybe this is the scene in the movie where the whole audience is crying, moved by the life you're living, what you've seen and done, and are trying to make room for now. We aren't meant to go it alone. We are clueless pack animals, clawless and pretty weak as far as animals go. Our bodies surrendered their power to our brains a million years ago. But it wasn't just exchanging claws for big brains. It was what we did with those brains, in particular, cooperation. How do humans cooperate in such huge numbers? How do we agree on money, on nations, on staying in the driving lane? Other mammals can't organize in groups larger than a few hundred. The thing that sets us apart from the other animals is our ability to believe in things. The wiring in our brains mutated in such a way that they gain the ability to hold concepts covering giant, abstract numbers of people. With language, we can construct unifying ideas like religion and country. Though I've never met you, you and I are French, therefore we are brothers. You and I are Catholic, therefore we are sisters. And we spread these constructs through stories we tell ourselves, words that organize what we observe and experience. One human would come to a wide river or bay and stop. On her own, she would be stumped by the natural barrier. But give her a tribe, a language, and a common desire, and she can build the Golden Gate Bridge. She can land on the moon or start a war. Next time you're making inside jokes with your friends, take note. You are exercising a superpower. You are casually engaging in the skill that took over the world and could someday destroy it. My friend Zach once said, "One person in a million lifetimes could never build a car." Think about it. One person couldn't do it. Mining the materials, the metal from mountains, copper, steel, the rubber from trees, digging up oil and refining it to gasoline, melting sand into glass for the windows, tanning leather, learning how levers and gears and motors turn, combustion engines, spark plugs. In a million lifetimes, one human couldn't do all the things necessary to build even one car. Humans make things. They build and expand and astonish. Each ant has his specialty, and we all add our single brick to the skyscraper. Exploring New York reminds me of this more than any other place. A human masterpiece built on a forest and a field and a swamp. Stone and metal materials shipped here from Chile, Congo, Brazil, stacked together, sewn into each other. Humans born in every corner of the world, drawn here as if by Devil's Tower, a city like an anthill after it's been kicked. Swarming and repairing and building. I hate getting rides from other people. What if I want to leave the dinner before my friend? What if I want to up and go somewhere else? I like my freedom. On top of that, I don't like asking for things because my worst nightmare is to appear needy, or worse, a freeloader. Youth can trick you into believing you are autonomous. You need no one. You are strong and free and will bounce when dropped. Last summer, I picked up some mystery virus that knocked me on my ass. I lost my appetite and could hardly stand in the shower. I went to multiple doctors, and they took lots of my blood and piss and stool and couldn't figure out what it was. I tried to play it down, order Postmates, and do it on my own, but I couldn't. I couldn't even walk to the end of the street. I spent 12 days on the couch and in bed. 5 days in, I couldn't look at Instagram anymore, because the sight of people enjoying their lives made me sad. I wished I could teleport to Tennessee and let my mom take care of me. But as soon as I grew too weak to protest, my friends and roommates swooped in like buzzards on a sick cow. They circled ahead until my knees buckled and I couldn't do it on my own. They made me bone broth. They brought me groceries and Gatorade and food and multivitamins and blankets and soup. When I was too weak to use my hands, I had dozens of pears around me. When I lost my clarity to choose, I had a swarm of backup brains. They say the average American does not have $500 saved in case of an emergency. That is not good. But man, I hope the average American has friends. Because bad things happen, and while you can live much of your life as a loner, there will come a time when you need help. To feel that warm rush of care when you've given all you've got and you fall to your knees. It is, I don't know, some core ground-level thing. A confirmation from a million years ago that we were meant to lean on each other, that accepting help is not a show of weakness. It's honoring the truth that got us here. We thrive together and fail alone. I've been to Burning Man twice. It is a massive art festival in the middle of a Nevada desert. A dry lake bed with powder white dirt and open skies and not one tree as far as the eye can see. People camp or sleep in RVs and spend 2 weeks making giant sculpture installations that dot the horizon. It is dusty, dirty, and fun. It is also a music festival and an experiment in zero waste living. It is, without question, the wildest man-made thing I've ever seen. It is like stepping into a Mad Max creative explosion. It isn't for everyone, but when I went for the first time, it was definitely for me. While wandering around on one of the last days, I stopped in a tent full of strangers to beat the midday heat. They were sitting in a circle, drinking kava tea, and taking turns explaining what they'd learned by living in the dusty desert all week. Some people talked about self-reliance. Others talked about looking for love. One girl said she had come to the festival alone and ended up finding new best friends. Then it was an older woman's turn. She was small and fragile and leaning on a cane. She said she had mobility issues and used a battery-powered golf cart to get around. It broke down 1 hour after her arrival. And when you can't really walk, getting around a pop-up city of 70,000 people is very difficult. "This was my first time coming to Burning Man," she said. "So many people told me not to come. They told me it was too hard." She started crying. "I broke down on the first day. The dirt, the heat. I had a full meltdown. My cart didn't work. I couldn't get anywhere on my own." But in her despair, angels appeared. Strangers started picking me up, pulling me in wagons behind their bikes, placing me on their scooters and buggies, and taking me wherever I wanted to go. They invited me to explore with them, go deep out into the playa and see the art. Everywhere I turned, I was offered help. By this point in the story, the woman was crying so hard, the words barely made it out. That week, she had seen art and dance parties and impromptu dinners, all because of the generosity of strangers. Her feelings of inadequacy, the injustice of her damaged legs, of her damn golf cart breaking down, had been met with jubilant kindness. As I sat listening to her speak, I felt my own strong legs folded beneath me on the bench. I hadn't even thought about them, about what a gift it was to wander at my whim, to hop on my bike and explore in any direction. It reminds me of something I once heard a pastor say. "There is someone in a hospital right now begging and praying for the chance to live one day like you're living right now." I don't know what is fair and what isn't. I didn't earn my health, and I don't think this old lady earned her infirmity. But I know that the love she felt was good, and that the privilege of ability is meant to be used for helping. I may think that someone has the perfect life and therefore doesn't need encouragement. Or I may see that they have it bad, but I don't want to bother them or offend them by saying the wrong thing. Either way, I assume things and stay quiet. A friend of mine is a famous writer. He's had big success and won awards and been on TV. He told me once, "When something major happens, no one texts me to say congratulations or tells me they're excited for me, except for my team, the people I pay. They tell me. I think my friends assume everyone else is doing that, so they don't. It sucks to achieve your dreams and feel more alone than when you were scraping by with the guys." Another friend of mine had his brother go to prison. It was a big deal. They showed it on the news and everything. I didn't call my friend because I thought he'd be so embarrassed. I didn't want to let on that I knew. A year later, I found out that through the whole horrible ordeal, no one called him. He said he'd never felt so alone. In his time of need, no one showed up, because everyone assumed someone else was doing it. You know that poster at the airport that says, "If you see something, say something"? That's become my motto. If somebody is killing it, I'm going to tell them. If they're hurting, I'll offer my hand. I'm not going to assume anyone else exists but me and them. No one who would do what I do to make my friend feel seen. More than 200 years ago, Adam Smith wrote that if a European were to hear of a terrible earthquake that destroyed the Chinese Empire, he might, quote, "express very strongly his sorrow for the misfortune of that unhappy people," end quote. But he would undoubtedly go about his day and fall asleep without struggle that night. Quote, "If he was to lose his little finger tomorrow, he would not sleep tonight. But provided he never saw them, he will snore with the most profound security over the ruin of 100 millions of his brethren. And the destruction of that immense multitude seems plainly an object less interesting to him than this paltry misfortune of his own," end quote. This was before the internet and television, of course, so the broadcast of faraway pain would have been limited to a newspaper story, to the imagination. The European wouldn't have seen crying faces or heard the voices of children, but he certainly would have known it was the death of millions of people. This is a moral disaster, but a feature of the human brain. Humans don't care well for things they can't see and feel. We didn't evolve with a global mind. Luis Moreno Ocampo, a renowned human rights lawyer, told me that an empathic response is more likely to be activated by three things: closeness in space, closeness in time, and likeness to self. It's difficult to feel empathy for cavemen because they were different from us, lived very long ago, and inhabited a world unlike our present life in our present suburb. 0 for 3. The wiring for empathy isn't triggered. If you are white, from a white world and a white suburb, and the suffering child is Chinese from a town you cannot pronounce, your empathic response will be diminished. This is our wiring, formed from a million years of not seeing any tribe that lived more than 100 miles away. I believe in a global world, in global compassion, in free markets and equal human dignity. But man, our little monkey brains really strain to process the world. They didn't evolve to do this, which is why we fight like we do. We're too big for our britches. 9 out of 10 people would murder a stranger by pulling a lever. This we know from a famous thought experiment in ethics, often called the trolley problem. Here's the scenario. Imagine you're standing on a bridge watching a runaway train speed down the track below. Down on the track are 5 unsuspecting, innocent people who will be run over. It's too late for the train to stop. But right in front of you is a lever. If you pull it, the train will switch to a different track where only 1 innocent person is standing. Would you pull the lever, effectively killing the one guy to save the 5, or do nothing at all? 9 out of 10 people would pull it. It gets more interesting, though, when you change the setup. Same scenario, but this time there's no switch. Instead, you're standing next to a stranger. This poor schmuck is just standing on the bridge, not paying attention, while the five people wait down on the track. Here comes the train. It will hit and kill the five when it passes beneath you. But if you push the stranger off the bridge, he'll land on the tracks and stop the train. This is assured to you by the psychologists who created the scenario. Just go with it. If you knew the simple act of shoving the schmuck would save five lives, would you push him? 9 out of 10 people say no, hell no. What's the difference? Same math, same loss of life. The only difference is the lever. Psychologists have observed that humans are deeply averse to violence when it's face to face. We have a deep instinct to avoid it, but remove them by one step, and that instinct is almost completely diminished. I first heard all of this on the Radiolab podcast's episode, Morality. It's a must listen. To me, this explains why bullying thrives on the internet, why road rage exists more than sidewalk rage, why drone strikes are ordered by presidents of both parties, and why governments waste money that isn't theirs. Our animal brains have no software for a world of buttons and levers and screens to hide behind. Anything beyond your relational and experiential world is religion. It's secondhand belief. You're gluten-free? Do you actually know what gluten is and how it's metabolized? Or did you just trust your doctor or listen to your skinny friend? How we engage in these massive systems of belief, from the American experiment to the economy to the environment, is all hugely important. What we believe matters. But remember, it's all religion. It's all fighting over this savior or that. I want to find the person who knows conservatives and progressives and people who are religious and non-religious, who eats with them, who laughs with them. Only that person knows what to do next. Or maybe they don't. But at least I know they are asking real questions, seeing the world with sober eyes. Trust your physical world more than the others. Trust the kindness of strangers on the sidewalk. You were designed for it. Spending time with Ruthie is a poem, a sermon. We have such a good time together. But it isn't just laughing and eating and making playlists. It's a lot of that, but it's also conversations on philosophy, spirituality, and processing mystery. Her chronic pain rears its head now and then. She has to lie down. She can't go from dinner to a bar because she's too tired. She comes to lunch late because she slept an hour the night before. One time, when we were visiting Vermont, a weathered lady we met said to us, "This year, the leaves are extra bright." "Why?" Ruthie asked, with her Louisiana accent making it sound like, "Why?" "It's because of the drought," the woman said. "The stress put on the trees brings out their brightest colors. You're very lucky to be visiting right now. The harder the year, the brighter the leaves." I've seen this in Ruthie. She can sit with someone in their pain. She actually sits down with them and holds their hand. She doesn't rush to tell her experience. She doesn't try to explain it all away. She doesn't say, "It will be okay," or "All things have a purpose." She sits with them. She nods and says, "That's so hard," and, "I'm so sorry, Angel." I am terrible at this. I tell the suffering person that everything has meaning. I try to make them laugh. I tell them it'll pass. Ruthie teaches me the value of suffering, the cost of the brightness of our leaves. The number of times I have heard people say, "I just met Ruthie and I am forever changed," is too many to count. How do you let a friendship go? Solve that sad calculus of realizing you have changed, and that a person who was once your partner in crime is now a reminder of something you've left behind. I can meet an old friend at a coffee shop for the dreaded, quote, catch-up, and search for words and stories, always falling back on the memories of when our lives were in right flow. But our lives are no longer in the same river. We're flowing to different seas. What of loyalty? What of remembering the old times? I think it depends on where and why you grew up. Did you find your true self when you became different from your friends? Was it freedom? Do they, even in their kindness and beautiful memories, represent ways that you used to be imprisoned? When I sit with a kindred friend, my effortless people, there is no catching up. Everything is understood. It's an explosion of futures. It makes me wonder how many people in this world feel understood by their friends. How many people are friends with the people who happened to be around, never knowing why they feel alone in a room full of their own. I am drawn to some people from across a room, without ever having to hear their voice. They can walk into a crowd and stand out to me like a lighthouse. When you're driving down the freeway and someone begins driving right next to you at the same speed, you notice them peripherally. You feel them there. You look left and see them keeping perfect pace, and for that moment, you are together, speeding down the road in the same direction. That's how it feels with some friends, a same speed recognition, a feeling of mutual momentum and direction. And then there are people that I'm drawn to precisely because they are different. Perhaps they have something I lack. I am attracted to Stoics because I am extroverted confetti. I am attracted to bodies because I too often get lost in my mind. I am attracted to people who can't find the right words because, in a way, not knowing what to say is lovely to me. I am attracted to people who express and heal their pain because I run from mine. It dawns on me that all my relationships are just chemistry unfolding. Equations seeking equilibrium, sameness finding sameness, and imbalance finding balance. I am water pouring down the mountain, looking for low places to rest and pool. I am meeting up with streams to form a river, and hopefully, ultimately, to join the sea. My friend Margie and I have grown through many seasons together. From building youth activist campaigns to deconstructing our Christianity. We are two very different bodies running the same software in our minds. A while back, we got to talking about growing up and the way our thinking has evolved in our 30s. She said, "All the things that used to make me mad, the Christian stuff, my parents, the exes, and aging, they just are now. It's like someone stole the charge right out of them." I can't get this thought out of my head, how I used to get so fired up about things, how offended I was when someone interpreted the Bible differently than I did, how frightened I was by intimacy, how cartoonish my expectations of adulthood were, how hurt I was when someone didn't invite me, how I spent entire evenings arguing over heaven and hell, music and marriage, how certain I was, fighting for such smallness. I see the world with different eyes now. I appreciate the time everything takes. The analogy of the orchestra returns to me, each instrument in its own time. The spirited trumpet has his solo, but the soothing strings come next. I wonder how I'll feel in 10 years, if the growth ever stalls or stops. I've seen some people lock into a way of thinking, build their sense of safety around it, and never learn a new thing. I've also met old people who go around with a twinkle in their eye, still surprised by their own words, still delighted in their unfolding. You can't make new old friends, unless when you meet them, your spirit jumps to your lips and shouts, "I've known you for longer than I've been alive. We are siblings from the stars." I was asked recently, "Who is your best friend?" I don't know. I don't use language like that anymore. It doesn't fit. I have friends that hold the keys to different doors of my personality. Some open my heart, some my laughter, some my mischief, some my sin, some my civic urgency, some my history, some my rawest confusion and vulnerability. Some friends, who may not be the closest to me, have the most important key for me in a moment of my life. Some, who may be as close as my own skin, may not have what I need today. It's okay if our spouses or partners don't have every key. How could they? It isn't a failure if they don't open every single door of who you are. The million-room mansion of identity cannot overlap perfectly with anyone. But I will say, my closest friends have a key ring on their hip with lots of keys, jingling. Who do you feel the most yourself with? That is a trick question, because I am many selves. I am myself when I am with my serious friends discussing politics and race and faith and wounds. I am myself with my playful friends when I'm cackling at a restaurant and getting shushed by respectable adults trying to have a respectable meal. I am myself when I'm with my fearless friends, hopping fences and sneaking into parks at night. I am as many people as I meet, the hidden parts of me being pulled out by the unique alchemy of every connection. Who do you hang with that makes you feel the fullness of one of yourselves? For me, Ruthie is a good example. She wants nothing from me but delight. She wants to laugh and talk, but she doesn't show up needing it. She knows only that mixing the ingredients of her and me make good things. We are interested in the same music, many of the same books and movies, the same cocktails and food, and the same people. Where we differ, we intrigue each other. Where we overlap, we feel understood. It's a weird thing being around people like that. Even though it might be frantic with activity and dinners and talking, it feels like rest. There is no work, no weighing or even thought of self, no doubt, no poison of wishing you were different. You stop holding your breath. You pant like a dog. But it is also like electricity, energy without a battery. It requires no fuel. The friendship itself is eternal combustion. Delight and laughter and mischief spring out of everything. The smallest, dumbest thing is comedy. We find the perfect taco or cocktail and scream, "Of course!" We make a scene and strangers notice us from across the way. Their forks pause midway to their mouths as they watch with worried eyes. Are these people about to burn this place down? The answer is yes. After giving a speech at a conference in downtown LA, I checked my phone backstage and saw a text from my friend Sophia. "Patch is in a bad way. I'm wondering if you, my chosen family, can come over and spend the day with me and him, and let's send him to heaven, surrounded by the love he's given us for 14 years. I apologized to the organizers that I couldn't stay for the meet and greet and ran to my car. I had to get to Sophia's house. Patch was a pit bull rescue with one eye. He lost the other one from a fight or abuse, no one really knows. But Sophia rescued this rejected, broken dog, and he traveled with her everywhere. Though his one eye gave him a hard look, he was a cuddle puddle, a kisser and a lover. He napped in our laps and licked us clean. When I pulled up to the house, the street was lined with cars. I had to park two blocks away. I wondered if someone else was having a party. But as I walked back up the hill, I saw that the cars were centered around Sophia's house. Once inside, I looked out the back windows into the yard. People were everywhere. I went out back and saw so many friends and dear faces standing and watching Patch eat ice cream. I had that tight feeling in my throat that comes with tears, seeing all my friends in one place, rallied last minute to be the love Sophia needed, to show Patch the love he deserved. Patch couldn't walk anymore or control his functions, so on his glorious last day as a dog, they had been waiting on him, feeding and petting him like King Solomon. They fed him bacon, salami, ice cream, all the things a dog could dream of. They let him drink beer. He must have gone numb from being rubbed and petted. When the kind-hearted vet showed up, Sophia assumed most of us would leave. Who wants to watch a vet inject a dog with death? And yet everyone stayed. There were probably 15 of us, and we quieted and took the posture of reverence. Patch was given something to make him fall into the deepest, loveliest sleep. Sophia lay beside him, spooning him on his bed. She whispered things to him that I couldn't hear. She giggled. He was snoring loudly. Then, he went to be with all the dogs that have loved humans before him. We were crying. I said to my friend Azita, "Take note. I want this when I go. I want this exact day." There are many lonely humans who have never known the love this dog knew. He earned it by the way he loved us. But first, He was invited into love. Sophia took a chance on him. He was a reject. He might have been mean and sad, a dangerous dog. But Sophia said, "I will be your home, your safe place." And he became the best dog in history. The power of the invitation. The words authentic and community don't mean anything on their own. Some things are meant to be byproducts, not causes or aims. We are desperate for authenticity and community, and in our haste, we mistake them for goals. But these things are like friendship, like flirting, like humor. If you talk about them, they retreat like a shadow in the light. You cannot discuss pheromones while flirting and expect your knees to keep touching under the table. Some things, some beautiful things, are the smoke and not the fire. In the same way, you cannot will community into existence. If you gather people around you and squint and smile and say, "We are such a community, how amazing are we?" Watch your friends run. Belonging is the first source of invincibility, of happiness. I had to speak at a conference in wine country a while ago, and I was nervous. I felt like an imposter. I can gab and chat like a pro, but an hour of giving a structured lecture makes me shiver. My friend Lauren, the one who started Kind Campaign, said, "I'll come with you and be your hype machine. A road trip, let's do it." There is something well-suited about a road trip and a close friend. The ability to talk while on the move, while passing through small towns and canyons and souvenir shops. You can oscillate between personal excavation and playful observation about the things you see while driving through rural America. Lauren is excellent at this. She can talk about a supernova, and then local Los Angeles politics, and then my love life, as if they were all related. She is a professional at locking eyes across a table with me when things get weird or precious. I feel such comfortable belonging with her. It's the confidence that comes from having a comrade, a friend whose counsel you seek and mischief you ignite. There are things in my life that make me feel small and dumb. For example, I'm a dizzy slob when it comes to my romantic life. I don't know what I'm doing or feeling, and my love of words only masks my ignorance. Lauren has a profoundly loving and balanced marriage, but she had her share of wild boyfriends and bad ideas and messy heartaches. She is on the phone every other day talking to one friend or another about their ghosting crush, a first date, a fluttering heart, or a confusing text message. I am embarrassed by my fumblings into the dating world. She is so thrilled by it all, it makes me open up. I feel less crazy when she pats my back. We drove hundreds of miles and spilled out our hearts and words. We played the song biography game, where you play key songs from your youth that impacted you. You first explain what they meant to you and why, and then you hit play. I was playing Alanis Morissette and Shane and Shane and Dave Matthews Band. She was playing Jimmy Eat World and Coldplay. We arrived at the conference feeling exfoliated and whole. I think I nailed the talk. She patted my back and said, "Good job, my dude." I want to make up a new word or find the word for the feeling. It will mean when a group of friends is in a moment and everyone hits a harmony of laughter or playing off each other. When we realize in a moment, maybe at sunset at Mount Hood or with beers around a fire or blazing the streets at a bachelor party, that there is no other place we would rather be. Where the moment is so fat with harmony that it's both spacious and weightless, passing painfully and at the same time immortal. How does someone find community, good friends? I get asked this a lot, and I don't know how to answer. But there are clues. The friends I have all seem to have certain traits in common. Our interests overlap. We like politics and art and television and books. We are funny. There is self-sufficiency mixed with open-handed generosity. We operate from celebration and delight rather than ownership and expectation. Then there were the gravity points. At 19, I moved to Los Angeles, one of the most creative cities in the world, full of creative people. I went to film school and then studied poetry in the English department. I met actors and film directors and wannabes who ended up becoming the real thing. I worked at a young nonprofit that made avant-garde documentaries about child soldiers and kids surviving a war zone. We uploaded YouTube videos and lobbied Congress and the Obama administration for human rights aid while wearing Converse sneakers. We wanted to save lives and make art while we did it. Of course, I found interesting people there. I'm 37 now, so I'd say I've had about 20 years of seeking real friendships. I've lived long enough to meet loads of people and grab on to the ones who sing my soul electric. Every one of them started as a bird who landed on my shoulder. They always could have flown away, yet many of them remain, free as a finch to visit my shoulder or not. I enjoy them and they enjoy me. We enjoy the freedom to continue to choose one another. But I will say, I am learning the beauty of loyalty, of history, of having years and years of one another. For a long time, I resisted seeing loyalty as a virtue. People who said they sought loyalty first were a red flag to me. It implied that they were trouble, like they'd been terrible people and had so many friends pull away and leave that now they were always talking about how many fake friends there are, how rare loyalty is. But I see loyalty differently now. I see it as time-tested friendship, as weathering many seasons together, of taking one another's advice. We do stupid things, we date the wrong people, or get back with the wrong ex, and yet the friendship survives. Because the connection is deeper than just enjoyment, just fun and laughs. It has become something more like family, where it's no longer a choice, but a given. At 37, I can feel my life getting smaller. I found the ones I love, and now we have something that cannot be found in a flash of quick connection. We have history. I will always be fascinated by the function of friendship. C.S. Lewis said, "Friendship is unnecessary, like philosophy, like art. It has no survival value. Rather, it is one of those things that gives value to survival." This is patently false. Of course it has survival value. It bonds us to one another, making our tribes strong enough to survive the chaos of life. It gives our social connections pleasure and stamina. It gives form to our social hierarchies, to who you can trust and who you can't. And, like anything in human life, it changes as it ages. Friendship in my 20s was an exercise in empire building. I had an endless well of energy to meet new people, to jump at the spark of a new connection. But my priorities are switching from breadth to depth. I have collected all my flowers. I have planted them. I am now focusing on tending to my garden. I am happy about this, and I will report back in 30 years. Truth, like love and sleep, resents approaches that are too intense. W. H. Auden. I would add friendship to this quote. You can't want it too bad, or you'll poison it. That's certainly true of love.